So had you booked your flights to Paris yet?
Wonderfully, I'm so disorganised that I hadn't.
Yes.
That is one of the first things I thought, that if I'd booked everything, so I know I'm going to be working. I think because there are still so many, although before the announcement today that we're going to talk about, that there were a few unknowns in terms of quarantining there and back, and I was just leaving it as late as possible. I just think in this day and age, just leave things. I've got friends who have booked holidays abroad in June, which is quite brave. July, still quite brave. August, maybe that's a little bit better. I'm still of the thinking of, I'll just leave it as late as possible. So no, nothing was booked. So it's fine. How surprised were you at the announcement that happened today, which is Thursday, that the French has moved a week?
Well, I mean, I suppose it is surprising, but everything's fairly flexible at the moment. I was going to ask, because obviously you were leaving it late to book your to make your arrangements, because things might change, whether it's quarantine, lots of things are up in the air. But did you think that the whole tournament might shift again? It did last year, so I suppose we shouldn't be that surprised.
I didn't think the whole thing was going to shift again, because it was... there was quite a lot that went on last year because they moved. I mean, fair play to them. They saw a window and they took it, but there wasn't discussion as there has been this time around, because there was the statement from Wimbledon saying that the Grand Slam board has been spoken to and we're all in agreement that this should happen. I didn't think it would be moved, because it feels like there's going to be... it's going to be... the calendar's going to become more and more normal as the year goes on. So at that time of year, there are things... I can't see a big block... I can't see how Indian Wells is going to move. I know they've got wonderful weather the year round, but I still, where do you find two clear weeks, which is what they'd need, because theirs is, what, a 10-day tournament to put in there, let alone a Grand Slam. So I didn't think it would be moved. But when they said they'd move it back a week, I didn't really know what kind of a difference that would make by a week. But then the French thinking is that the beginning of June, they want to start opening up sport.
Yes.
So not... to not just Roland Garros. So, and remember last year, the big thing from Roland Garros and the French Tennis Federation was, we do not want a behind closed doors event.
Yes.
That was their big thing, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. That was, and initially...
and they didn't, for the most part.
Initially, well, they were going to have 12,000, weren't they, initially? And that was going
to be...
It changed a lot.
Flexible.
But it was, we'll move it to September, October. We plan to have three sections, 12,000 people, and we'll go from there. It ended up being 1,000 people that were split due to the situation. But the big thing for Roland Garros was, we do not want a behind closed doors event. This is not what this event is about. So I think by pushing it a week back, they're hoping to have some kind of crowd at the tournament.
When I first heard that it was being pushed a week back, I was sort of similar in terms of, what sort of difference is that going to make? Really, things are not great in France. That's how it is when it comes to the COVID numbers, and the vaccinations haven't really taken off in the way that they have in other places. And it's looking tough. They're in a lockdown, and it looks like it was possibly going to affect Roland Garros. There were some people had written some articles saying there's a chance it might be cancelled, but I didn't really see that, because we played through a lockdown last year. And it was fine. And I just think that they would go to, as best they could, keeping people safe and healthy, they would go to any lengths, really, I think, to put on the tournament. It's such a huge event for them. So I didn't really buy into, like, it might be cancelled. I just thought, nah, it's probably going ahead. But there might not be anyone there. Apart from a few players knocking around.
I'll be there.
Yeah. And Gigi, of course. But yeah, no, it definitely... I was a bit confused, but then when I read more about it and the plan from the government that they are going to start opening things up mid-May was what I read. That's what you were saying, right? Mid-May. So it was like, okay, well, just give Roland Garros an extra week, and then hopefully they will kind of be into that.
If you were a player, because it is quite a late call because the clay season started, would this... because Elise Cornet, I think on the Tennis Channel, she was... it was breaking news almost for Cornet, and she was immediately like, oh, this is terrible, and they don't tell us, and this is planning, and it's all, How much of a disruption, if at all, is this going to be? We can talk about the knock-on effect for a handful of tournaments that are due to and might still fall. They're discussing it in the what is now the second week of Roland Garros. But as a player, finding this news out today, how much of a disruption would this have been to you, if at all?
Well, I'm not sure how much, because at first you feel like, as a player, you know, every day is kind of scheduled down to the minute, and they're so precise. They're real control freaks, are athletes. And you would think, wow, this is the sort of reaction to Elise Cornet that she had, that, oh my God, what am I supposed to do now? And you sort of feel a bit all out of sorts. But when you actually look at it, players don't like to compete the week before a slam. We found that out in Australia, right? It was very difficult for them, especially when things got delayed. And we saw that in the States as well. Somebody like Naomi Osaka pulling out the week before a slam again, and then winning the slam again. So it is, you know, we know that particularly the top players, the lower ranked players, maybe 50 down, don't have so much choice, and are probably not expecting, although we do love it when they make the second week of a slam, they're not expecting to make it the second week of a slam. I don't know, maybe some of them are, you know, too good. But but you know what I mean. And yeah, I think actually when it comes down to it, it doesn't make that big of a difference. It means that players won't be needing to play the week before. Yes, it's a shame. Really, do you know what? It's a shame for the real grass court players that want to peak for the grass, for example. They want that extra week that the grass court got that season, got the 3 weeks between Roland Garros and Wimbledon was huge. And I think it really revived the grass court season as a whole. It's still very, very, very short when it comes to the very long season that is tennis in the year.
It's tiny, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
2 weeks.
Now it's just 2 weeks again. But Wimbledon said it's not moving. So there will just be 2 weeks between Roland Garros and Wimbledon if you are in the second week. Now, the vast majority of players are not.
And there's still talk, as we're recording this, that the tournaments that fall in now the second week, I mean, they could still go ahead, right? Because as you say, a number of people that would have been in them anyway could still be in them because they won't be in the second week. It's not ideal. And those tournaments that might get a huge name that has a shock defeat in the first week of Roland Garros thinks, well, I'm just going to go here to get some more grass. No, they're probably not going to get that person, but they should still have enough people to have an event.
Yeah, it's like my Andy Roddick story turning up to Surbiton.
Yes,
remember?
Yes.
He used to love turning up. Played a bit of dubs until the practice courts opened at Wimbledon, and then off he popped. Said that's enough of me, thanks.
But then they'll still be able to have a tournament. And I can see, and we need tournaments big and small, every size, catering for every person. But you have to see why they would prioritise a Grand Slam, because we talked about this last year. This is where players are picking up large amounts of their money, not alone points, but in terms of if you can take part, be in a Grand Slam draw, the money you are making might keep you afloat, especially if you can crack through the four in a year. So you need to prioritise Grand Slams, right?
Yes, I think we do, as much as the tours are incredible organisations and an incredible display of the sport, and they really create so many jobs. The WTA and ATP, I think they do an amazing job. They really do hang off of, I think, the slams throughout the year, and everything is around those Grand Slams, like the grass court tournaments. It's no surprise that the grass court tournaments are played before Wimbledon. That's just apart from Newport, which is lovely. Yeah, it's played post Wimbledon, but but you know, you have seasons, and those seasons reflect the slams, which are the major events. As much as we love Miami, we're going to talk about Miami, reflect on that as well, and so many of the other tournaments, and some of the really small tournaments are so charming. Like I say, charming sounds really sort of a bit patronizing, really, doesn't it? But no, that's not what I mean. I love some of the small events. I think they're fantastic. But I think for something like Nottingham, I don't know what the LTA are thinking when it comes to that event. I don't know if an option is to decrease the size of it. When I say size, in terms of the points and the prize money, because they're just not going to be getting the same players that they would have been expecting. And maybe they just sort of drop it down to be a 125K event or something. I'm not sure. But those, I don't know where they're going to fall with it. I doubt they'll cancel it. It doesn't seem like they have to cancel it, because Roland Garros is going. As I say, there are not many people operating in the second week of a slam.
It is crazy to think about it, that, and I know it was for so long, but the grass court season, 2 weeks. don't know. It could be.
I know. And now it just seems ridiculous.
It just seems. But that's ridiculous. We can't call it a season, can we? I guess it is because it's on a different surface. But it's. And you can see why some players through their careers have just taken a hit when it comes to grass, because they've just think, you know what? It's. I know there's a Grand Slam and it's a very prestigious one, but it's just everything that maybe they need to adapt or to do or to change or to get comfortable with, and they don't feel comfortable with just for those 2 weeks. And now they don't even have that little bit of extra breathing space. Literally, you finish on the clay, and if you're going deep in the second week of Roland Garros, then it's the grass season, and then it suddenly it's upon you, and then it's finished. It's weird.
Yeah. But I know it's a flash. It's a glorious green flash in the tennis landscape every year.
I love that. A glorious green flash. I think it's, but it's going to be interesting. And I guess for people like you and I, working on it, I'll have to still see how it's possible to come back from Roland Garros with where we are with quarantining to then work at coming back into Queens and things. So there's lots of it's logistically it does change and complicate things for players, people working in the sport. So I don't know how that will shake down, because again, we don't know where respective countries are going to be with COVID and vaccinations and whatever in a few weeks' time. So there's still a few, but I get what you mean about, as athletes, every second is you know what you're doing. So suddenly someone says, by the way, it's a week later. And for moments, your world falls apart. You're like, how can I possibly, mm-hmm. how can I possibly do that a week later?
Yeah, it's not happening. Yeah, I know.
And I was thinking, oh, well, I get an extra week after Rome. I thought, well, that's nice. I get a little bit of a breather.
Yes.
And we should say that Madrid and Rome, as we speak, it's been quoted that they're not moving because they wondered if Rome might adjust a little bit.
Sure.
But it's come out, and from what I've heard.
I personally think it would just be too much to start reshuffling the whole schedule. Honestly, I think Roland Garros moving back a week on its own is absolutely fine. Leave everything else where it is. It means that there will be a slight knock-on effect for Wimbledon in terms of people won't be able to prepare as they would like for Wimbledon. But Wimbledon dealt with that for years, as you were saying. It's fine. It's part of it. It's just for this year. They understand that that's how it is. Wimbledon's not going to move. They're way too far into their planning to entertain that sort of idea. And you know, and that's it. Just be a week later. And yeah, I mean, it does have an effect on us, I suppose, a little bit more. I mean, we don't have any sort of travel exemptions or anything like that. We're just your old regular public, as it were, moving around the place. But I did think selfishly, I was like, well, do you know what? May was pretty busy when it came to Madrid and Rome. And I'm doing Lyon as well. So I was like, that is a busy month. And to have a week off after Lyon before Roland Garros starting, great.
But I had the other side of it. I went down to my other half, and in terms of what I've done in previous years, I said to him, so from childcare purposes, I'll have 3 weeks in Paris for Roland Garros, straight back for Queens, then to Eastbourne, then a couple of weeks of Wimbledon. And he just looked at me as if I was speaking a foreign language. And I said,
yeah.
And then there'll be a break after Wimbledon. He's like, he just went, okay. I don't think he took any of it in.
Going to gloss over June. I think that's better. June's not going to be a fun month for anyone.
It's a bit like an Elise Cornet. I was just sort of getting stuff out. I just heard the news and I was like, so it'll be this, possibly this if it happens, and then that. And he was just stared open mouthed and went, all right then. And we've got the twins' birthday in June as well. So, yes, not so convenient from a work point of view. There's a little extra juggling that needs to be done around there. But look, it's all going to shake out. And just think, this time last year, our diaries were empty.
I know.
Empty.
Oh, the memories.
I was convinced they'd be filling up. You were convinced there'd be nothing in our diaries ever again.
Well, you still thought Roland Garros was going to happen in a few weeks.
It did. It happened in September. I'll stand
by that.
In a
few weeks.
So we've now got everyone sliding around on the clay, but we haven't spoken since the end of Miami, which saw one final that you could have got a lot of predictions for, and one final that if you even tell me you even thought about predicting this final, you're not going to be believed. Is that fair to say?
I think so. And you know what? quite nice for once that it was the other way round, because normally the men's final's been predictable. At least one of them has been pretty predictable. And then if it is only one of them that was predictable, the outcome was very predictable when it came to the final of a Masters. And whereas the women's, you sort of like, Świątek in the final of Roland Garros. This is amazing. This is great. What a breakout star. And then Kenin and Osaka and all these players when they first broke through. And so for it to be like, okay, yeah, it is Barty against Andreescu, that was fairly expected. I know, difficult because Barty's been away for so long and Andreescu's been away for so long. So that, of course, has made it just all the more special. But in sort of, you know, they're both Grand Slam champions, as it were. And then for the guys to be a couple of youngsters going, hey, let's have a Masters title up for grabs. That was... really bizarre that way around, but very cool.
And two just really nice guys that just, you know, afterwards Jannik Sinner said he's my best friend on the tour. But I thought what was quite funny, and I don't think he meant it, was, so for people who don't know, they probably do if they're listening to this pod, it was Hubert Hurkacz that came through and won. James Blake, the tournament director, I thought it was a great, the tournament director does a little bit of, well done to both players, you're amazing. He turned to Jannik Sinner, runner-up first, and it was... basically, you're amazing. I'm sure you're going to win this like millions of times. You're going to win millions of titles. You're just a legend. And then it was to Hubert Hurkacz. Well done. Congratulations. Sort of in brackets. I'm not sure you'll be back here again. It just, ooh. I'm sure he didn't mean it, but it was the kind of, I think we're so carried away, and probably rightly so, with Jannik Sinner. I mean, is there anyone that doesn't think he'll be number one? Is there anyone that doesn't think this kid is going to win the biggest prize out there? Probably not, because mentally, physically, game-wise, the guidance he has, the way he talks. I mean, this guy is a solid bet as any, if he stays fit, for reaching the top and staying there. I don't know if that's a bold statement or not. Hubert Hurkacz, fabulous player, fulfilling his potential. So good he won it. Would, if you told me now, do you think he's going to win Grand Slam? I'd probably say no. Is he going to win?
Yeah. Are you in the same camp as James Blake then, thinking that he's just going to be Thomas Burdick?
And I don't want to be speaking for James Blake, but it was just, I remember as we were listening, it was, he was so effusive about Jannik Sinner, you know. Maybe he was just trying to make him feel better because he hadn't won the title, but it was kind of like, don't worry, fella, we're going to be doing this a lot more in your career. And then it was, Hubert, well done, what an amazing achievement, which it was. It just felt a little bit like... I don't know. Maybe Hubert is not going to win thousands of these. Maybe he will. Maybe this is the door-opening, career-defining moment, and Hurkacz will...
But you don't think he will?
No. Do you?
Yeah.
Do you?
I know... Do you know what? I know what you mean. And as I just mentioned there, it felt like he had sort of pegged him to be this sort of Thomas Burdick type, as in, well, then you've won a Masters... And I think Burdick won his Masters in Paris quite early on, didn't he, in his career?
Yes,
I might be making it up.
Did.
But it wasn't late in his career.
Yeah.
He went quite early on in his career. And then obviously after that, it was like, yeah, you're going to win a slam? No. These guys are just that level better than you, right? And obviously there were a number of them competing. And for Burdick, as much as he was just such a world-class player, he was just steadily in that rest of the pack, right? And I can understand why people would put Hurkacz in there, because I think similarly to Burdick, he just sort of comes across as a bit too nice.
Yeah.
You know, do you know what I mean? I always talk about, you know, with Djokovic and even with Andy and even I think very subtly, very deep down with Roger, a bit more obviously with Nadal, they do have a lunatic streak in them, like an absolute lunatic, just terrifies you, right? And you look at someone like a Hurkacz, you're like, you don't have that. That's not in there, is it?
You just want to give him a cuddle. It's just
a lovely chap.
Did you know?
But then I do think that in the Masters, I do think through Miami, it did feel a bit sort of like, okay, he's got a bit more about him than I thought, I guess.
I think also he was on this wonderful run, having won Delray Beach in that part of the world. He'd been living out there. The conditions-wise, he was maybe the only one not affected by these conditions throughout the course of the tournament. He was playing some amazing tennis as well. I think everything fell into place. Not that it won't fall into place. I feel awful saying this because he's such... Like, IMG offered him a suite at the hotel to live in. He gave it to his coach, Craig Boynton, because he had his daughters with him to stay in.
Nice.
I mean, how nice is that? That's.
I mean, it's not superstar behaviour, is it? That's the thing.
It's just so nice. It's. Oh, look, we've talked about this with Cilic. We've talked about this with Burdick. And look, Cilic is a US Open champion. But I look, if someone said to you now, you can put your house on Sinner or Hurkacz to win multiple titles, Grand Slams and Masters, where's the house going?
Well, it's Sinner, yeah.
So, sure. But
it's much more about like the attitude, though, isn't it? It's about him as a person, the way he talks.
Yeah.
I mean, all this sort of analogy people have been getting stuck into on Twitter about potato peeling and being a chef in the kitchen, or that sort of thing, and him being just so, so far away from where he wants to be, which is, you know, he's looking at Djokovic, he wants to be like him. And it's obviously possible because we had Djokovic, Federer and Nadal. Three of them have managed it to be operating at that level. So it's clearly not just sort of a one-off prodigy situation. If three can do it in the same era,
yeah,
and surely it's easy.
Sinner was a champion skier at the age of eight. Eight.
Mm.
This kid was sort of representing Italy doing, and he said in the end, you know, the choice, it was easy in the end because skiing, you just sort of go downhill and that's it and you're on your own. But tennis, you have to figure things out and it's a game and you're continually improving. And just the way his mind works, the way he says, and I don't believe he's just saying it when he says it's not about trophies at the moment, it's about progressing. And it's easy to say, yeah, easy to say that. But I genuinely believe that is the mindset of him, and he's on a path and he knows where he's going and he's not in a hurry to get there, and he will get. It's frightening. His mentality is frightening. I mean, the game is fabulous, but for me, at his age, it's the mentality.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. So excited. I'm just really excited to see where he's at 5 years.
And also very happy for Hurkacz. I want to say that. Very, very, very happy because he's a lovely fella. And
yeah, and I mean, he's also one of the young generation coming through, but he's already 24. Isn't that amazing? Like, because he was part of the next gen at the beginning.
Of course he
so
was,
I kind of still consider him as a next gener, but I was sort of surprised when I just double checked on my notes, like, oh, he's 24 already, like, because you just think of him as so young. But it does take that time, unless you're Sinner, to sort of settle into it. I mean, he's got a fantastic game. He's clearly a great character, a very nice guy. You're breaking all sorts of mold, I suppose, for Polish tennis as well, because they don't have a huge amount of players to get stuck into. Now with him and Świątek, it's sort of like a new era for Polish tennis, much like it sort of is for Canadian tennis as well. Russian tennis is, that's more of a resurgence than anything, because we've of course got the big Russians, but it is interesting these nations really pushing forward.
And I think Miami, especially on the men's side, without all the headlines pre-tournament, who wasn't going to be, there was a chance for someone who was there, a chance to look at the younger players and how they cope in the pressure and the heat and the humidity, what kind of expectations, because Daniil Medvedev's 25. I'm still going to call that young, but he's a top seed at a Masters for the first time. How does Andrei Rublev cope in a situation under pressure? I just found it a very interesting tournament for those young guys to see what they can do, because that's the future, because the old guys are going to get even older and eventually stop playing.
Yeah, but I think, isn't it interesting, the mentality for like a Rublev or a Medvedev or a Tsitsipas, for example. The Tsitsipas maybe slightly less so. But, well, no, that's unfair. I'm going to include Tsitsipas in this as well. But that I think they were almost more comfortable when there was a Djokovic or a Nadal or a Federer standing in their way. And it's because I just think it just changes the expectation. And then if they beat them, they'll be beating them probably in like the semis or the final. And to come through that and then win the Masters title, I don't know. It just felt different, didn't it? Because they weren't there, and it's been such a long time since they haven't been there. And I think that as much as we didn't really know what to make of it, I don't think the players really knew either, because we saw them. I mean, Rublev was talking about how he struggled with the pressure. Tsitsipas too. It was, it was difficult for them. I think Medvedev sort of did himself into the ground a little bit with his physical efforts in his matches, his hobbling around. But yeah, it was.
It
was very much an
opportunity. Blanket.
Yeah, it is. I think so. It's an obstacle. And actually, if you then clear the obstacles away and you say, go on then, they go, actually, I don't know how to do it. It's a very different mentality, but I thought it was interesting. They'll get the hang of it.
Yeah. No, I'm sure they will. They get the hang of it.
Can you let them know that Naomi says they'll be fine.
You're going to be okay and you're going to get the hang of it. Now, your matches, were you split between the men's and the women's? How were you?
Yes.
When you were covering, so you saw, I was following it and keeping an eye on it. And we've talked a lot about Ash Barty. Oh, we've talked a lot about Bianca Andreescu's fitness. And I think it was you. Did you send me a message saying, yeah, it was you that told me Andreescu had to retire from the final?
Yes, I know. Pretty. It's devastating, really, isn't it, to be honest?
Yeah, it
really is. But I mean, she took a fall and it was one of those falls on her ankle where it didn't look horrendous because her, because her foot did not entirely cave over, you know, when it sort of goes in a funny direction, but it went in a sort of direction, which is, that was how I sprained my ankle quite badly. And it was just a certain movement. It was very similar to how she did it. And it doesn't look that bad, but actually it's really, really painful. And it swelled up and just needs a bit of rest and that sort of thing. But it is tough to play on. But yeah, I think she was pretty heartbroken, because these injuries just keep hanging around, even though this isn't necessarily a serious injury, she can get it sorted. But it's not like her to give up. It's not. I just think she could be 6-love, 5-love down, and I would not be surprised if she turned the match around. You know, she has that thing about her that she doesn't quit. She's turned so many matches around. I was looking up her record from being a set down. I think I was talking about this last time, wasn't I? I mean, it's phenomenal. She wins far more matches from a set down than she loses from a set down. It doesn't make any sense. So, yeah, very, very unfortunate for her. But I have to say, I mean, Barty was just class. I mean, it's not that I'd forgotten how great her game is. It's just that it was the first time since the resumption, I think, that it has been on display against a player of that level who was playing so, so well. And that first set was just, oh, I mean, she was just manipulating the ball. And you could just see Andreescu couldn't get her teeth into it, because she would get this nasty slice and it would be this, and then Ash is at the net, and then Andreescu would get pulled forward and then she'd be passed. And she was just so, just not able to get the rhythm that she wanted. And it really just sort of reinforced why Ash Barty is number one in the world. I still believe that Osaka's the best player in the world right now. It's just the way that the rankings are that Ash Barty remains as number one. But hey, who knows? Maybe if she'd come and played Roland Garros, she would have won it. I don't know. She didn't play. So, you know, maybe if she played US Open, she would have won it. We don't know that, do we? So it's easy to sort of, I suppose, move her down the pecking order because she's been away for so long. But I will still stand by that. I think Osaka's the best player out there at the moment. But, I mean, Barty, possibly for, say, grass and clay, she could be sort of just eating up those slams for a while as Osaka and Andreescu battle out the hard courts.
And a big thing for Barty was defending such a big title. She said that's the other thing people have got to remember, that she was... I kept forgetting she was defending champion in Miami because it was so long ago. And I had to keep reminding... And the same with on the men's side of things. I had to go back and think, wow, okay, that was... Okay, Federer, wow. So I kept forgetting that she was actually defending champion, because I know we had all that talk about how Osaka could have got to number one. But I think that was a big thing for Barty. And I also think with Barty, look, this is her career, she loves it, but she's also, last year she made the decision not to travel, to stay in Australia, wait to see what happened. She's made a big commitment now to base herself away from home till the end of the season. And that is a long, long time for someone who's really a homebody. She loves nothing more than being at home. Maybe we all do, but there are some who like it, crave it more than others. And I think it's very much that she sat down with her team and thought, right, if we're going to do this, it's everything. You know, I'm not saying people come into these things half-hearted, but I think with Barty especially, it's a team effort. It's very much we, it's not I. She's made this big commitment not to go home, and I think she wants to make the most of it. And just, yeah, to see her game in full flow, as you said, was awesome. And now to think of the clay and the grass, and what do you think Osaka can achieve on the clay and the grass?
No idea. Honestly, absolutely no idea. I think as long as she can accept that she's got quite a lot of adjusting to make on those surfaces, then I think she'll be absolutely fine and she'll fly. But I think up until this point, she's had a bit of a mental block on it. You know, people always talk about how her game's really suited to grass, but she's just always said, I don't like playing on grass. How can it be well suited to grass? I don't like it. But then Ash Barty didn't like clay and she won Roland Garros. So
that's crazy.
There you
it?
Go.
That's...
You know, you just don't know. But of course, I mean, Osaka's got just what seems like a never-ending supply of potential on all surfaces. So I would not be surprised if she just figured it out and was fine.
We need to talk about scoring. Now, this first came to light on social media. It was The Overrule that posted this video of a clay court tournament featuring Astra Sharma, who wasn't given the breaker serve she deserved. The umpire calls the score as 30-15 when it should have been love 40. And then in the words of The Overrule, and from then on, it's one big mess. And I've watched the video and I think the two things to come out of this. Firstly, how an umpire can get it so wrong. But second, some of the grief that Sharma got for not keeping the score. I mean, I don't know. I've not been in this situation. You can tell me differently. You remember the score. You don't remember the score. I don't know how lost you can get. But she seemed to get, Astra Sharma, an awful lot of grief for not keeping check of the score. But you have an umpire, if you're at a match with an umpire, to keep the score. Surely. I mean, where do you sit in this?
Oh, I totally feel for her, because it's not that she's not keeping the score. It's that she's not paying attention to the score being called out, because, you know, you're walking to your towel, you're concentrating, you're thinking about the last point, you're thinking about the next point. You're not paying attention because it sort of just fades into the background. I mean, you know what it's like when you're commentating, you just the umpire, you just hear the 30-15. It just, you can't be paying attention to every single time they call the score out to be sort of like, what's the score? Because you know the score, so it doesn't matter. You know it's 30-15. You don't need to listen to them for 30-15 for reassurance. So you just sort of ignore it. And I think she was just playing. She thought that the score was carrying on from love 40. It was love 40, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it was called 30-15. And I think she lost the next point and then just thought it was 40-15. And just she just carried on playing until... It became apparent that the umpire had a different score. But then by that point, you're a few points later, and it's very difficult to remember. You know, when you're a junior, if you're scoring the match yourselves and you get confused between you and your yourself and your opponent, they'll say, we'll go back to the... They ask you to talk through each point, what happened on the first point, second point. I mean, there is almost always one point that both players can't remember. So as in, if we've played 5 points in the game, I can't remember the second point of the game and my opponent can't remember the fifth point of the game, but then we don't know know which one's telling the truth. So you very, very often you know, get confused. So I totally felt for her. I think she probably could have protested it more once she sort of realized what was going on, but by that point there's nothing you can do about it. Like, the scoreboard says it. And you do, you just start second guessing yourself. I mean, the same thing happened to me. I was playing a junior tournament in the south of France in Cap Dai, and I was playing against Tamira Pashek.
How old were you? Junior? How old were you?
Oh, 16.
Okay.
16. It was in the final of this big junior event. And I was playing Tamira. And I think it was at a really crucial point in possibly the second set. I think it was straight sets, but sort of like two all opportunities to break, that sort of thing. And yeah, they got the score wrong. The scoreboard, it was an electronic scoreboard, and the umpire just changed the scoreboard and did it wrong. And then what had happened was that the umpires second guessed themselves and then looked at the scoreboard and went then with the scoreboard, and then I kicked up a fuss a couple points later again because I hadn't looked at the scoreboard, and then I kicked up a fuss saying, no, I've just broken her, I've just won that game.
No.
And then they said, no, you haven't. And I was looking at my team, who didn't really give me a lot. They kind of looked at me like confused themselves, because I was looking for them to be like, yeah, you won the game, and then I go, okay, fine, and then I could dig my heels in. But I didn't get a huge amount from that, and but I did have a long conversation with the umpire, and I got a little bit upset about it because I was like, I know, I can tell you all of the points. I know what's happened.
Whoa.
And anyway, we just carried on, and I ended up losing the match, not because of that, but, you know, it's just part of the match. But then afterwards, with the award ceremony, all of the organisers had seen it as well. But like, they're not going to jump in unless I demand for somebody to come in. And even then, the chances of them overruling the umpire are very, very slim. I don't think they would do that. And yeah, and then afterwards, they all sort of spoke to me and told me that I was right. And then,
that's even worse. That's almost even worse.
And my coach went nuts at me for not sorting it out on the court. But I was like, I wasn't sure. I didn't know. And then they awarded me with the sportsmanship award. So that was nice. Because apparently I dealt with it really nicely, but I didn't really deal with it. I was just like, oh, okay.
Is that because of your age? Or if you'd looked, or were you quite a stroppy 16-year-old? Or if you'd looked at your camp and they'd given you a bit more like, go on, girl, you'd have got stuck in more? Or a combination of the two?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I never really liked to have a go at umpires. I always felt like, you know, they're doing a job and the people are going to make mistakes and it's fine. But as I say, I didn't really get the reassurance from my camp. But it's one of those things that it then like plays on your mind. You're thinking about it in the next game and the next game. You're thinking, I'm sure I was right. I'm sure I was right. And you don't have that closure.
So did it therefore have an effect on the way, the outcome of the match if you were still kind of thinking about it? How could it not have had an effect on the rest of the match?
Only when I look at it in hindsight, I played Pashek a number of times. I was not going to beat her. So I think
starting from a good, positive place.
It was the first time I played Pashek. And I remember I played at US Open Juniors as well. We had an awesome match. It was like 4 1/3. But that was like me playing my absolute best tennis. So and we were on clay and I didn't like clay. So like, yeah, it was just a... I really don't think it had any bearing on the result of the match, but it was just a bit of a shame because it just really changed the momentum of the match. Loads of people were watching. Loads of people there to watch the final and stuff. But you know what? My very favourite trophy that I've ever won is that sportsmanship trophy. And it's not because it's sportsmanship, because that...
Is it?
No, because sportsmanship is pointless and useless and I'm not interested at all. And they gave it to me and I was like, are you kidding? But... it's the nicest trophy, the actual physical thing.
As in looking?
Yeah, it's the most beautiful thing. Trophy that I have. So I love
you
it.
You still got it?
Absolutely, I love it. Yeah, it's great. It looks amazing. But you just don't want to read it because it says like sportsmanship on it. So I need to scratch that bit off.
So then if your winner clips the top of the net, you don't apologise?
What do you mean?
You know, the ball clips the net and you win the point. And then there's the apology. Oh, sorry, I got a bit of luck there.
No, I apologise.
I thought you wouldn't do that if you don't agree with like sport. That's being good sportsman, apologising.
Yeah, no, it's fine to be a good sportsman, but a sportsmanship award, I mean, come on. Telling me that I played by the rules, well done.
Like... Yeah, but not everyone does. And it just means that you were kind of a little bit above the rest. Is it not?
Mm.
No?
No, they had to give the award to someone. It was finals day. There weren't many people around. So it came to me, but it's a really nice trophy. So it was so much nicer than Tamira's trophy she got for winning.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was chuffed with it.
Maybe they swapped them round because they felt bad for you because you should have had that game. Maybe it was actually the winner's trophy. They just got the plaques and they pulled them off and switched it and stuck it on the other one.
Maybe.
So maybe that's
great. I'll show it to you sometime. Trophy. It's a really beautiful. It's this lovely glass bowl, and instead of like a fruit bowl, but instead of having fruit in it, it's got tennis balls, glass tennis balls in it. It's very cool.
Oh, can you take the glass tennis balls out or are they kind of welded
Well, they were all attached, but since a few knocks and stuff, one is loose. You can take it out and throw it around if
you've
you
got
want.
A loose ball.
But it is glass.
Oh, yeah, that sounds quite nice. Ball. And it stops you filling it up with fruit because it's got its own balls in it. But I thought, poor old Asa, she did say, I was told... He wasn't sure of the score, but since I couldn't tell him how I won the points, I couldn't delay the match arguing with him. And then this is her word. She said that a supervisor said she should learn her lesson and focus more on the score instead of her tennis, which...
Well, that's nonsense. I'm sorry, but whoever said that that's not fair. I think what she's saying is fair. That is the thing, is you have to be able to prove it. And if the umpire say, and you're good on the umpire for actually telling the truth and saying that they weren't sure as well, they'd got a bit confused because it happens, right? Everybody's human. It's not a problem. But you then need to be able to remind them of what has happened and say, don't you remember that mark over there? That's where I hit the backhand.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I hit it over here and she hit it in that net. And then it was love 40. And honestly, sometimes they'll go, yeah, I do remember that. Or your opponent might say, oh, yes, because if you disagree with somebody over the score when you're scoring yourself, they'll say, oh, okay, yeah, I remember that. And it's fine. But if you can't do that, they just go, well, you can't just tell me the score's wrong, but then not tell me, you know what I mean? You have to be able to back it up.
So yeah, it's like if you go to court, you've got to state your case. They're going to say, so what's your case to prove this did happen or didn't happen? You've got to state exactly. And if you can't say, well, I'm not quite sure, then it's, that caused a little bit of a stir on social media. Do you, by the way, do you want some chocolate? Do you like chocolate? I don't even know. Do you eat chocolate?
Definitely. I'm the biggest chocoholic you'll find.
Are you?
Yeah.
I don't think I ever knew that. Because I've got a lot of chocolate. I've got...
Excellent. I'll be around.
I had the pre-Easter. They haven't got enough chocolate. So I just kept buying it, forgetting I'd bought it. And then had a lot of it. And then the Easter bunny is still a thing. Like, he's real. So I had to wait up till about 11 o'clock because they kept looking out the window to go out in the garden in kind of -1 degrees or whatever this ridiculous weather is we're experiencing to hide eggs all around the garden, which then 6 o'clock in the morning, the kids are trying to go outside to get the eggs. So nice. We've got this whole feast. And then the school laid on an Easter egg hunt, which is a really nice thing to do. You know, you walk the streets and there's letters in windows.
Death by chocolate.
But very early on, I realised that the Easter egg hunt round where we live might take a good 2 hours. Two hours.
It's over the whole of Windsor.
2 hours. It's pretty much in not the warmest conditions. Dragging two children around who after the first two letters kind of over it. And you go, oh, mummy, there's an E. And I'm like, oh, there's an E. Mummy, there's an A. And then they're like, they're done. So luckily, early on, one of the mothers told me what the phrase was because you had to put together a phrase. And then you hand your thing in at the end. So luckily, one of the mothers told me very early on what the phrase was. So I was like, I've got that in my back pocket. And then I'd say about 8 letters in, the boys were like, can we go home? Bored yet? Can we miss out these? So luckily, because I knew the word, I did a little negotiating and maybe we completed half of it, but just happened to know what the phrase was in the end. Because the phrase meant chocolate. Because you filled it in outside the last door. There was a little box of chocolate. He had more chocolate. So we got more chocolate. We sort of sidestepped half the... I mean, 2 hours with two children when it's about 6 degrees. That's quite a lot, isn't it? So now we've got a kitchen full of chocolate. I'm trying to re-gift it.
Great. Send it over this way.
So you want some chocolate?
Definitely.
Am I going to be seeing you
For Monte Carlo, yes.
So
Monte Carlo start soon.
So we're both working on Monte Carlo?
Yeah.
So I can re-gift you. I've got some baby weaning books and some chocolate. Does that sound perfect?
That sounds perfect.
I mean, we haven't talked about the tennis, but we're going to talk about the tennis. And, I have with me a baby weaning book.
Perfect.
And some chocolate.
Perfect.
Sounds like a date.
I can't wait for Monte Carlo.
Oh my God, I'll see you next week.
See ya.
Bye.